Culture Affidavit, episode 155. Born in the USA. Hello and welcome to episode 155 of Pop Culture Affidavit, the podcast that takes a look at everything random in the world of popular culture, which is brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network. I'm your host, Tom Panarese. So 40 years ago this month, one of the biggest albums of the 1980s dropped. And if you haven't guessed what that is by both the title of this episode and the intro music, it is Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA. Released on June 4th, 1984, it was a monster hit, staying on the Billboard album charts for so long that it was actually the best-selling album of 1985, and it would go on to sell more than 30 million copies worldwide. The album gave Springsteen 7 top 10 singles, although no number one, and launched him into the pop music stratosphere, putting him on the same level as 1980s icons Madonna, Michael Jackson, and Prince. And this album happens to be one of my top five favorite albums of all time, which it has been since I first heard it when I was a kid in the 80s. It's actually been a while since I did a full album episode. In fact, the last time I looked at an album from beginning to end was probably when I interviewed Chris Lynam for the episode about his band Wasted Time and their album When It Was Fun in episode 120. Prior to that, you have to go all the way back to February of 2014 in episode 23, which is when I talked about Green Day's Dookie. That album was billed as the album that changed my life because it's being released when I was 17 and how it led me to discover an entirely different genre of music. And on some level, I guess that you could say Born in the USA was life-changing, because it was one of the first albums that got me into an artist that I would stick it with for years afterward. So in honor of its 40th anniversary, I'm going to take a look at it, giving my history with it, and giving a quick look at every one of the album's 12 songs, as well as consider its legacy. I'm not going to get too much into the backstory of the album, mainly because there are entire videos, articles, and books that you can read and go into granular detail about it. I will mention that it was recorded over 2 years, as a number of the songs came from a demo tape that Springsteen put together around 1981 or 82. That tape had all the songs that would become the album Nebraska. But whereas Nebraska is acoustic and significantly bleak, Born in the USA is a full-on rock album, and its sound came to define Springsteen for so many of us in the 80s. The cover is, of course, iconic. It's an Annie Leibovitz photo of the boss's ass. All right, to describe it a little more fully, there's a flag in the background and Bruce is wearing a white t-shirt and a pair of blue jeans that have a red baseball cap stuffed into their back pocket. It is honestly a perfect image if you're going for symbology to accompany the phrase Born in the USA. Although, as I will point out through a number of songs, the title and the iconography are ironic at times, as the lyrics of many of the songs are far from positive or are patriotic anthems to the United States. I first got a copy of this album in either 1985 or 1986. I'm pretty sure it was 85. Either way, I was in elementary school. I remember the first time I heard the album was because my friend had the tape and we listened to it over and over when we hung out together. But I'm also pretty sure that I knew who Bruce Springsteen was. I'd heard the song Born in the USA and maybe Dancing in the Dark or Glory Days before listening to the album from beginning to end. My parents listened to the radio on a regular basis, and I was also a regular viewer of Entertainment Tonight. Yes, I was watching Entertainment Tonight when I was in the second and third grade, but there was definitely more than one segment about Springsteen on that show. In fact, they would occasionally show music video clips over the end credits of the show. So I'm pretty sure that's where I actually saw part of the Born in the USA video. The timeline, of course, is fuzzy because we're talking about when I was very young and sometimes the years blur together a little bit. But I will say this. I knew nothing of music when I was that age other than the copy of Thriller that I owned on cassette. I asked for this, and I remember that I wore the tape out listening to it, to the point where somewhere in high school I actually went and bought another copy so that I could listen to it on my Walkman. I did eventually get it on CD, and 2 years ago I got it on record as a Christmas present. I got rid of the tape years ago. I still have the CD, and I of course have the record. Now, the album is iconic, and it's well remembered by any of us who, well, had a pulse in 1984. But the thing is that the album isn't cool. At least it's not cool in the rock snobs sense of the word. I recently read a review of the book There Was Nothing You Could Do, Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA and the End of the Heartland by Stephen Hayden, which I immediately put the book on my wish list. But Chris Klimek, the reviewer for the Washington Post, writes, as Hayden points out in his preface, almost no serious Bruce fan claims Born in the USA as their favorite. It was too contemporary sounding, too accessible, representing the only time Springsteen directed his hopeful but essentially fatalistic worldview at fickle listeners who'd never sit still for the 43 relatively down-tempo minutes of Darkness on the Edge of Town or the bleary-eyed introspection of Nebraska. And of course, there's my personal encounter with uncoolness when it comes to the record. One day, my senior year of high school, I made the mistake of leaving my backpack unattended in the cafeteria when I went to the bathroom. My friends rifled through it, wrote "nice ass" on the tape cover, and sang Born in the USA very loudly when I returned. In their world of Metallica, there was no place for the boss. And when you think of it, though, it's kind of an asshole move to rifle through someone's stuff when it's unattended. But anyway. So what happened to the album? Well, for me, for years, it was a favorite. It still is a favorite. But for years, it was like a sentimental favorite rather than like a best album. In geekier terms, like my favorite Star Wars movie is Star Wars. The best Star Wars movie is The Empire Strikes Back. And the biggest reason my favorite movie is Star Wars is that I had a VHS copy of Star Wars when I was a kid, before I got Empire Jedi, and I watched that VHS copy more times than I can count. I still have the tape. So it holds this deep personal meaning for me because, like, this was my Star Wars. Born in the USA was kind of the same thing. And I could tell you that, like, probably Born to Run is his best album. But saying that and then, like, but I do love Born in the USA because it's a sentimental favorite, gets the get out of jail free card for the rock snobs. And that's stupid, ridiculous. Because while Born to Run from end to end, in my opinion, is his best album, this still is my favorite because I've listened to Born to Run a number of times, like many, many times over the last 30 years or so since I first got it. I've listened to this probably double that. So this is more of an honest opinion or evaluation than a way for me to save face. I mean, I'm way too old to deal with people who are going to be pretentious asswipes about music choice. I mean, for all my going back and forth between genres and streaks of favorite bands that have included punk, rock, metal, new wave, ska, pop, folk, Born in the USA is one of the albums that has always been there. It has never gone away. So I'm going to take a dive into it. And I'll do that after the break. And what I'll do is I'm going to go through the album song by song. So stick around.
Grom, I have never prayed to you before. I have no tongue for it. No one, not even you, will remember if we were good men or bad. Why we bought, why we sold on eBay. All that matters is that 50 Cent Captain Kirk Mego action figure. That's what's important. Cheapness pleases you, Grom. So grant me one request. Grant me the fruit of Suburbia's garage sales. Let me drive those dealers away from that box of records and hear the lamentations of the children as I buy their Star Wars toys for a quarter. And if you do not listen, then to hell with you!
Hello, I'm Chris Honeywell. and I make my living going to garage sales and then selling the junk I find on eBay. That's right, just like those assholes on TV. You can hear a podcast all about it where I tell you about all the good junk I got, how I sold it, give you tips, gripe, bitch, and moan, and even have friends come along with me. So check it out. It's called Garage Sale Gloat, and it can only be found at twotruefreaks.com, which is, of course, the home of the Two True Freaks Network. Duh.
If you're unfamiliar with it, that tune is the original version of the album's title song. Recorded for Nebraska, Born in the USA matched the dire tone of that album, but it was shelved in 1982 and then rewritten into the anthemic hit that we all know. I'm not going to get too much into that. Instead, what I will do, if you want a deep dive into the song Born in the USA, go to episode 61 of my old podcast, In Country. That was the show that I dedicated to Marvel Comics, The Nom. And back in the back half of some of the episodes, and in that episode, I covered some pop culture. So that episode covers issue 54 of the comic, and then I think it's a Punisher issue. And then after that, in the back half of the podcast episode, I talk about the history of the song Born in the USA and its significance when it comes to Vietnam vets and the political and cultural landscape of the mid-80s, including how it was misappropriated like crazy as a patriotic anthem in some cases and still is. And look, I did not get the irony when I was 8 years old. I had no idea what K-San was. I just thought that singing Born in the USA was awesome. Of course, I was eight. Yeah, that acoustic version of the song was released on the box set Tracks. And I'm going to get to Tracks later on. But for a little while, I talked about Rock Snobs earlier. Liking the acoustic version of Born in the USA is superior to the original released version was another get-out-of-jail-free card for Rock Snobs to like the song. Because if you said that original acoustic version was much better than the rock anthem version, it gave you legitimacy because Nebraska was a more legitimate album than Born. Honestly, I like both. The acoustic version is more direct, of course. It's haunting. But what I've come to love about the album version of Born in the USA, the one that opened this show, is that it is a perfect indictment of Reagan's America, as is much of the album. 1984 is a pivotal year of the decade, as well as a pivotal year for, at the time, America's self-image. It's a presidential election year, of course, and Reagan was running for a second term. He would get that. He would soundly defeat Walter Mondale in the November election. But this is also a year where patriotic iconography starts to ramp up, and for more reasons than just the Reagan campaign, even though that's a big part of it with mourning America, right? Because you also have like the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles, for instance. And if you want to hear me talk about those and the Mourning in America re-election campaign, go to the Olympics episode of Fallen Walls Open Curtains. I went into depth about that. This album is another thing that bathes itself in that iconography of the flag. Now combine that with the fact that the country was finally out of the recession of the early 80s. There was a real atmosphere of pride in the country that would take us through much of the rest of the decade. And look, I'm not going to get into the weeds on how gilded that was, because I'm fully aware of how underneath the sheen of the Reagan 80s, there was a lot of suffering. But if we are talking imagery, it really is this, right? When it comes to this album version of Born in the USA, the other thing I love about it is the irony of the tone. I love this idea that it sounds one thing and the lyrics belie it. So, and I'd love to get into a deeper dive on that idea of like, here's a song that's telling us what the 80s were really like for so many, but sounds a little more positive than it actually really is. You know, think about Mellencamp's trilogy of Scarecrow and the Lonesome Jubilee. You know, that's another episode for another time. But like things like that, where you break down, you go past the good riffs and the really cool rock music, and you see stories about people who are trying to get by the best they can. It's almost a type of Americana that we really should put in the spotlight more and more, because it's really, really good. Anyway, this song, Born in the USA, went to number 9 on the Billboard Hot 100, and of course is the defining song of Springsteen's career. Interestingly enough, the next song charted higher than Born in the USA, yet Born in the USA is probably more well-known these days. But the next song, number 2 on the album, is called Cover Me. So I would put Born in the USA as a no skips album, probably, maybe with an asterisk, because if there is a skip, it's this. There's no real reason for that, except that the next song is Darlington County, and I love that song, so I'll often skip Cover Me to get to that song. This could have been On the River, maybe even Darkness. In fact, it was originally written for Donna Summer, but Springsteen kept it, and he wrote Protection for her. It would have been interesting to hear Donna Summer sing this, because it's clearly Springsteen trying to do sexy and lustful, and it sort of works. In an era of Madonna and Prince, the boss going a little bit out of his usual lane doesn't measure up, though. I mean, points for trying, but knowing that he wrote this for somebody else and that artist probably could have done a really bang-up job with this, and like, you know, this is good, but there's better songs in the album. For instance, this next one. So I mentioned that I used to skip Cover Me to get to this song, because when I was a kid, I thought the song was a funny story song. The guy the narrator traveling with is named Wayne. It's my dad's name. Now, when you listen to the lyrics, it's about two guys on a road trip going through the South, because Darlington County's in South Carolina, I believe. And they pick up two prostitutes, spend the night with them, get separated, and one of them gets arrested. The song's this like Lost Weekend in a bar band song. I still find the story funny, especially the last lines. Driving out of Darlington County, I seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. Driving out of Darlington County, seen when he went up to the bumper of a stately Chris Ford. Oh! But I find it funny for different reasons, I guess, than when I was a kid. Something I've come to like about a lot of Springsteen's story songs is how so many times the melody can be an up-tempo rocker, but the characters are very flawed and in a number of cases damaged. Despite his success, he's always been able to pull from his upbringing, which was gritty and stereotypical, kind of working class. And I don't want to stereotype it, his characters are not the cleaned-up cookie-cutter suburban types that you'd see on a sitcom of the time. Their realness comes through the sheen that he's presenting. And Darlington County is a great example of that, as is Working on the Highway. In my head, I keep a picture of a pretty little miss. If I recall correctly, the working title for this song was at one point Child Bride, and it was recorded for the Nebraska album. I could hear it there in a different form, or I could actually hear it on the river as well, because it would go pretty well with that album's title track and other songs like Independence Day, even though the tune of this is more upbeat than those. The story here is a guy who falls for a girl and her family does not approve. He winds up getting in trouble with the law. If this girl is underage, as the title Child Bride would have suggested, this one is much darker than the melody suggests. It's kind of like when you look at the Pearl Jam song Alive and then realize what it's actually about. There's an underside to this song that I think gives it substance that it wouldn't have otherwise, because it really sounds like it belongs in the 50s or early 60s alongside Duane Eddy's Rebel Rouser, and the lyrics add the seriousness that had been added to rock since its early days. Incidentally, on February 26, 1999, Springsteen came on Late Night with Conan O'Brien to more or less retrieve Max Weinberg, who was the show's band leader. And of course, the drummer for the E Street Band, right? And when he came on, he played this song with the band.
Tonight, Max is going to be leaving us for a little while, and we're going to miss him. I'm actually a little worried about you, Max. You got a ride home tonight? You okay?
Yeah, Conan, I'll be all right.
Actually, I heard that maybe a friend of yours stopped by, give you a ride back to Jersey.
Yeah, I got it covered. I knew.
All right. Is he here? Right now, you're I just want to make sure you got a ride. Let's get your friend out here right now and see.
Nice. I didn't realize what you've been going through. You're just a little road work. You can lose a jacket. What about the top? Well, Friday night, paint a guy's fresh out of work. Talking about the weekend, scrubbing off the dirt. Some heading home with the family, some are looking to get hurt. Going down the
stove, trouble on man. If you want to watch the whole clip, I'll link it to you in the show notes. It's great. I actually saw this live. I don't remember why I was watching Conan at the time, but I did see it live. It was really cool to watch. Now, I've mentioned the whole working class thing, the downbeat lyrics, other stuff that you hear on the three previous Springsteen albums, often which have more downbeat tunes. I don't think Born in the USA gets enough credit when it comes to that, by the way. I mean, we talk about the anthems, we talk about the things that were bar band songs and rock songs and stuff, but there are other songs that have a more morose, sadder tone and are more straightforward in presenting something that is sad or a struggle. And for example, there is this one, Downbound Train. This is a great down on your luck piece. The narrator has lost his job, his relationship. He's completely on the outs. He's living in that undercurrent of the Reagan 80s, much like Mellencamp would do in Rain on the Scarecrow about farmers who have hit hard times. Springsteen does this with your average working guy whose job has gone away. In this case, it's a lumber yard, not a factory, but it's the type of struggles that so many of the time could identify with. By the way, I never remember the lyrics to the last verse because, well, I mean, you listen to it.
Sledgehammer, a railroad gang, knocking down that cross-ties working
yeah, like the lyrics are, by the way, "Now I swing a sledgehammer on a railroad gang, knocking down those damn cross ties working in the rain. Now, don't it feel like you're a rider on a downbound train?" So instead of like, I can't, that second line, "knocking down them cross ties working in the rain," I never hear that when I listen to the song. Anyway, we close out side A of the album with "I'm on Fire."
"Hey, little girl, is your daddy home? Did he go and leave you all alone? I got a bad desire.
This was one of the seven singles from the album. It went to number six in the Hot 100. Its video was more dramatic. Instead of a concert video, Springsteen actually acted in it. He plays like a mechanic. It won the VMA for Best Male Video. It's been covered many, many times. In fact, there's an article on Stereo Gum that lists 20 of the best covers of the song. I'm not sure that it's his most covered song or anything, but it has to be up there. I'll make sure that I put the link to that in the show notes. But on that list, there are covers by John Mayer, The Airborne Toxic Event, Barry Gibb, Tori Amos, Kenny Chesney, Big Country, Mumford & Sons, Brian Fallon, and of course, Johnny Cash. In fact, it made sense that Cash covered this because this is Springsteen kind of doing Cash. I mean, I'm not that familiar with Johnny Cash, but it sounds like this is Springsteen's closest Johnny Cash-esque song. And I can't really add to what's been said about it, probably. I mean, it's a, no pun intended, slow burn of a song. It's synth forward, and it uses synthesizers really, really well. If I can offer any insight, it's a song that recalls Nebraska, but also previews his next album, Tunnel of Love. It's also the shortest song of the album. It comes in at 2 minutes and 36 seconds. Now, granted, the longest song of the album is Darlington County. That comes in at 4:48. So this is a lean album, and I think it's another reason it's so great. Now, as far as "I'm on Fire," it's in the list of Springsteen's best slower and ballad type of songs. So that closes out side A of the album. I'm going to get to side B in a moment. But before that, I want to talk a little bit about B-sides for Born in the USA. So the 80s is Springsteen's most prolific decade, and it's his best decade commercially as well. While there were only 12 songs that made it onto Born in the USA, the album, there were supposedly upwards of many, many other songs. I think by that point, he'd written 70 other songs that never made an album. And a number of them were published or written during that 1982 to 1984 era that produced both Nebraska and Born. Some of the tracks were eventually covered and actually charted and became bona fide hits for other artists. Joan Jett, for instance, covered "Light of Day" for the movie of the same name that she starred in alongside Michael J. Fox. More famously, Natalie Cole's version of "Pink Cadillac," that was the B-side to "Dancing in the Dark," hit number 5 on the Hot 100 in 1988. You could not escape Natalie Cole's "Pink Cadillac" in 1988. It was on the air all the time. Another B-side that still gets plenty of play these days, albeit only on an annual basis, is Bruce's live version of "Santa Claus is Coming to Town." That was a B-side on "My Hometown." Now, in the mid to late 90s, a number of those tracks became available beyond B-sides and hard-to-find singles or live bootlegs because of the release of the Greatest Hits album in 1995, and more importantly, the 4-CD box set Tracks in 1998. The acoustic demo of Born in the USA is on disc 2 of that box set. The songs on the disc 3 are by and large all of from the Born in the USA sessions. I'm going to talk about 5 of my favorite here in lightning round fashion. So first up is Murder Incorporated.
Murder Incorporated.
probably one of the most famous sought-after B-sides in the years since Born in the USA. This is released on the Greatest Hits album. At the time, this was a pretty big deal, partly because we were getting, quote, new Springsteen with the E Street Band for the first time in nearly a decade. Now, I didn't get that at the time. I'd listened to quite a bit of Springsteen's music by then, but I wasn't up on the biographical history of him or the band. So I included it here because of that noteworthiness. Next up is Janie, Don't You Lose Heart.
Listen to me, Janie, don't you lose heart. No, no, no. Janie, don't you lose heart. No, no, no. Janie, don't you lose heart. No, no, no. Janie, don't you lose heart.
I first heard this song on the tribute album One Step Up, Two Steps Back, the songs of Bruce Springsteen, which I referenced in the cover songs episode I did with the Daly Brothers. On that album, the song is covered by Mrs. Fun and Tina and the B-Side Movement.
I'll take your sorrow if you want me to. No, no, no. Come tomorrow, baby, that's what I'll do. Listen to me, Jenny, don't you lose heart. No, no, no. Jenny, don't you lose heart. No, no, no. Jenny, don't you lose heart. No, no, no.
It's a sweet, almost folk rock song that would fit in with groups like Indigo Girls, which kind of what that cover sounds like. You can hear them even though that's not the Indigo Girls. Actually, it's a vibe that fits Tunnel of Love a little bit more. And by the way, there are days where I love the original version of the song, and there are days where I think the cover is a better version. They're both really, really good. Cynthia is the first track on disc three of tracks. That's my third choice. Always just like this song, especially the way it kind of channels Manfred Mann's doo-wah ditty. Of course, Manfred Mann, by the way, would go on to cover Blinded by the Light, and I think he had a number one hit with that. But I think what I love about this song is the way that you can picture Cynthia's slow, cool, confident walk. It's a great song about a woman. That's what I really like about it. Now, the last two B-sides I'll briefly mention both have two versions on different CDs. First is This Hard Land.
We've been going around from town to town, looking for a place to land where the sun could break through the clouds and fall like a circle, the circle of fire down on this hard land.
The original version of the song is on Tracks. It was recorded during the Born in the USA sessions, but then it was revisited for Greatest Hits in 1995, and it was one of three tracks that Springsteen recorded with the reunited E Street Band. They did this really good, like, concert special that aired on PBS, I believe. I remember catching it a couple of times, flicking around and watching it on PBS, and I remember really, really enjoying it. I'll have to track that down and watch it again. Anyway, I actually like the version of Greatest Hits a little better because this feels more like a draft of what we hear on This Hard Land, but it's kind of cool to hear that original version and then the reworking of it later. Now, this last one is two versions, but like two completely different versions, and that Springsteen recorded one in 1983, and then again in the 90s for two separate albums, and it didn't make either album. It's called Brothers Under the Bridges, and the first one, Brothers Under the Bridges 83, was recorded for Born in the USA, but it was not used.
Yeah.
And this is part of the version recorded in 1995 for The Ghost of Tom Joad.
Saigon, it was all gone. Same coke machines as the streets I grew on. Down a Mesquite Canyon, we come walking along the ridge. Me and the brothers on the bridge.
Now, I mentioned the two versions of This Hard Land. They're really, really similar. It's almost like here's the draft, here's the final copy, and it follows the same sort of progression. They sound very much the same. These are kind of like the Born in the USA versions, right? In that they're completely different. I like both equally. The 1995 version is a somber reflection from the point of view of a Vietnam vet. The 1983 version is a more upbeat and actually reminds me of No Surrender, which, by the way, is the first song on the B-side of the album. They are actually two completely different songs when you look at the lyrics, too. But I grouped them here because they have the same title. So it's two different perspectives of one different subject. Really, really good songs that are worth listening to. But like I said, the 83 version sounds a lot like No Surrender, and that's what's going to start side B. This song has a particular place in my life. For years, it was my favorite Springsteen song. I'd say it's still up there. Honestly, I don't know if I have one favorite Springsteen song over any of them all. I have like a playlist of favorites I could give you, and that playlist probably changes as I go. But while I heard it for the first time, I heard No Surrender for the first time, and the album when I got it on cassette, it actually took the New York Mets to make me like it. So, it's a random day during the 1986 baseball season. I sit down to watch a Mets game on Channel 9, but there's a rain delay. And what Channel 9 usually did back in those days was find something to put on until the game resumed. Because who's going to listen to Tim McCarver fill all that time while you just have footage of rain coming down at Shea, right? And McCarver could fill that time. Anyway, very often they would put on like a sitcom they'd had the rights to or whatever, but sometimes they had something baseball related. I want to say I remember seeing reruns of This Week in Baseball during rain delays. I don't know if that's completely true. TWIB is going to get a blog post or an episode at some point, by the way. Anyway, what I do remember seeing, and this is on that day in 86, was the highlight video about the 85 season. And that highlight video was called No Surrender. I stayed back and watched the whole thing. After all, 1985 was my first Mets season. And since Channel 9 had gotten the rights to use the song, or the Mets had gotten the right to use the song, it was all over the special. In fact, it kind of wore it out over 45 minutes or an hour or so, however long that highlight reel is. And hearing it enough made me really, really like it. And then I discovered or remembered that it wasn't Born in the USA, and I played it all the time because I already had the tape. To this day, by the way, I cannot find a copy of that 1985 Mets highlight video. I can't find it on YouTube or the Internet Archive. If anyone has it, let me know. Send it my way. Anyway, the other memory I have is my very last day of college. And that was May 15th, 1999, a little over 25 years ago. So that was a whirlwind of a day. I had to get up that morning. I had to head down to the Baltimore Arena for my graduation ceremony from Loyola. And after that was all done, I had to head back to my dorm room to clear out and clean out because we were supposed to be off campus by 7:30. So we ended up having the graduation dinner the night before. Once we got back to campus, my parents headed to Long Island to take my grandmother back. And Amanda drove back to UVA because she had finals still. And I was there by myself with my few roommates who were still around. And we were all scrubbing down our nasty ass dorm room because we had to clean the place up before we left. And I got my part done and then left probably around like 6:30 or 7 o'clock. And once my car was loaded up and ready to go, I put in side B of Born in the USA. I put it into my tape deck of my 1991 Hyundai Excel. I rolled down the window because I didn't have air conditioning in that piece of shit car. And I cranked No Surrender as I left campus for the very last time. It was dorky as fuck, but have you met me? And hey, I've always loved the second side of Born in the USA actually more than the first because of the songs that are about friendship, that are having about having perspective on life, such as the next song, which is Bobby Jean. Well, maybe you'll be out there on that road somewhere. Now, from what I understand, this song is about Steven Van Zandt. He had left the band sometime around 1984, I think. I don't know if he was on tour with them for Born in the USA. I don't think he was. And I have to be honest, I could have looked this up, but I didn't. Anyway, I get this song more and more as an adult than I did when I was 8, 16, or 22. So many people have come in and gone out of my life at this point. And there are so many from when I was younger who I no longer know. But while this song has a wistfulness to it, it also has a maturity. He is not lamenting that his friend has gone and wants him to come back. He's accepted that they won't be together anymore and is saying one last goodbye, hence the line, good luck, goodbye. He captures something about male friendship and emotion so well that very few pop or rock singers have been able to do. And Bobby Jean, it's such a great example of that. There's something very sensitive about it and actually professes a friendship that is like a love between two guys that is really earnest and honest. And in an era or in a culture, really, because we're still in this culture, that does not allow for that. Very, very often. So the next song is another breakup song. It's called I'm Going Down.
Way out of bounds. Well, you let out
This is another single from the album. It hit number 9 on the Hot 100. As far as up-tempo breakup songs go, I put it second on the list, just below the Greg Kinn band's The Breakup Song, as like great breakup songs of the 80s. Because The Breakup Song is the Greg Kinn band song that has the line, "They just don't ride them like that anymore." You know, that song, which is like such a great, great song. Anyway, because it's like, screw this, I'm out of here. This is more of a like, I can totally see this relationship is ending and there's like frustration, but at the time it kind of is like, all right, forget it, right? It's not lamenting something, it's not being sad about the breakup, but it's also not like an F you. It's just kind of like, you know, what's the point anymore? So it's a good piece. And it's one of four straight solid rock songs on side B, the next one of which is Glory Days. And that was a number 5 hit and another signature tune of this era. So what else can I put on the Midlife Look Back playlist alongside this Billy Joel's Keeping the Faith, Mellencamp's Cherry Bomb? This song was always a hit because it was so huge in 1984-85. There's references to baseball in the first verse. I think that had a big thing to do with it. When I was a teenager, I turned the last line from the second verse into a dirty lyric. And when I was in college, my friends had this inside joke about me in the song. To this day, I don't know what it was or why they had the joke, aside from the fact that they just like to make fun of me all the time. It did that a lot and then told me I should learn how to take a joke. Actually, funny thing is, and I'm not doing this just to be mopey, it made me not like the song for a little while. I did eventually come back to it though. Now, as for Glory Days itself, I'm going to use a phrase I've used more than a few times, which is bar band. It really is a good rocker of a song. The lyrics, which much like Born in the USA, belie the party-like tone of the melody. The first verse is about the narrator meeting an old friend from high school. The second is about him hanging out with the hot girl from high school. And the third is about him going to the bar to hang out. And throughout all those times, he talks about having conversations about the past, or as the title suggests, the glory days. In the liner notes of the Greatest Hits album, Bruce says that the first verse actually happened. The second is something that he wished would have happened. The third verse is happening now. And if anything, the final lines of the song, "And when time slips away and leaves you with nothing, mister, but boring stories of glory days," it encapsulates that nostalgic feeling so well that it elevates it above kind of substanceless pop. And that's what I really, really like about that piece. We have two more songs left in the album, and up next is Bruce Springsteen's Greatest Hit. It's the highest he ever got on the Billboard Hot 100. This song peaked at number 2. It was held back by When Doves Cry, and it's easily his most 80s song of the 80s. It is, of course, Dancing in the Dark.
I get up in the evening,
guess this is one of the track that separates the, quote, real Springsteen fans from the, quote, fake Springsteen fans. I don't know. I get the feeling that, quote, real Springsteen fans don't like the song. I like the song. I've always liked the song. The lyrics are about writer's block. Springsteen was writing about how hard a time it was writing a song that could possibly be a hit, because I think he and John Landau got into an argument because Landau said that there wasn't a hit single on the album yet, and he went and he wrote it, but he wrote about how he was having a hard time writing a hit single. And I see the irony as well, right? Plus, it does exactly what a good pop song should. It makes you dance, tap the steering wheel, sing along, even if you don't intend to. We all know those songs, right? Song comes on the radio, you're too lazy to reach for another station. Then a minute and a half later, you're belting out Mbop while driving on the Staten Island Parkway. Not that that ever happened. But Dancing in the Dark, though, like, expertly uses the two instruments that almost destroyed rock in the 80s, the synthesizer and the saxophone. So you've got to give it points for that, too. Honestly, I'd suggest putting aside any snooty thoughts you have about the song and just enjoy it for what it is, which is a really, really good rock pop song from the 80s. Now, I can't talk about Dancing in the Dark without talking about the video, which features one of three moments that Brian De Palma put into the zeitgeist during his directorial career. The first, of course, was the prom scene in Carrie. The second was pick a moment from Scarface. And the third is Bruce singing Hey Baby and pulling Courtney Cox on stage to dance what would eventually become the Carlton. Finally, we close the album going back to where we started, and that's a look at the underside of Reagan's America in the 80s. But whereas where we started with the anthemic Born in the USA, we are going to end with the softer, more somber My Hometown. This is a nice bookend to the title track because it has that same failure of the American dream that Born in the USA and Downbound Train have. And much like I'm on Fire, which closes side A, this also uses a synthesizer to great effect. But really, it's the lyrics that make it. The 80s were the height of baby boomer nostalgia for the 50s and 60s. And very often that was shown through a rose-colored lens of a simpler time. Kind of still is. It's where we start in the song. But Springsteen pushes past the nostalgia to what's going on today. And that is, his hometown has become a ghost town. It's fallen on hard times, and he's even thinking of leaving. But not before he closes the circle that was opened at the beginning of the song by showing his son his hometown. He would follow this up with Tunnel of Love, which is a more intimate record. Later in the 90s, he'd record The Ghost of Tom Joad, which is more of a folk album than a rock album. This could fit on either of those. A good sequel to My Hometown is the closing track on The Rising, My City of Ruin. And honestly, like, I wonder what my hometown would sound if you just swapped out the synthesizer for another instrument, like a guitar or a piano, straight piano. It'd be interesting, you know, even though you don't need to do that for the song whole hold up. The song holds up after 40 years with the synths. This, by the way, topped out at number 6 on the Hot 100. So after all that, what is the legacy of Born in the USA? Well, obviously this made Springsteen a superstar. He went on to have a huge tour afterward, selections of which are included on the Live 1975 to 85 box set that was released a year after this album. If you've never listened to that box set, it's really, really worth it. It's such a great live album. I believe they've recently released a live version of Born in the USA. I think if I saw my Spotify correctly, because I haven't listened to it, it's each of the songs on Born in the USA in the order on the album, but played in concert. So I'll have to give that a listen. And he's had successes since the 80s. I mean, this isn't like he's some sort of like Kajagoogoo or something that like never really hit anywhere as high as like were kind of a trivia note for the 80s or maybe in like a Duran Duran or somebody who are still kicking around but never hit the heights that they did in the 80s where they were the biggest thing in the world. He did hit heights, you know, obviously this was his time in the stratosphere, but he's been so consistently popular over the years that the guy doesn't really need the charts anymore because he's had a successful 5-decade career. And, you know, there's stuff that comes after this, which is great. I was not a huge fan of the two albums in the early 90s, Human Touch and Lucky Town. There's some good stuff on there, but there's also some meh. I haven't listened to The Ghost of Tom Joad in a very, very long time. The Rising is one of my favorite albums of his. And then you get his 2000s output, which is really solid. Magic is a solid album that's worth coming back to. A Letter to You, which is one of his more recent albums, was a really, really great album. And it's great to hear that he's still going and the music continues to evolve. But I always come back here. I replay this as much as any other album because it's really, really good and it's really fun. And yes, it is for everybody, but why not? You know, why not sing and rock along to this as opposed to having to have some sort of cerebral experience with whatever your music is? I mean, you can have everything. You can do everything. But yeah, this is still one of my favorite albums and a formative album in my life. So if you've never listened to it or you haven't listened to the whole thing all the way through in a long time, I highly recommend it. It's an hour well spent. Now, before I go, I have a little bit of feedback about episode 153. That was the one about song parts. Professor Allen told me that if I hadn't mentioned Jim Steinman, he and Michael Bailey were going to show up at my house with pitchforks and torches. So I'm glad I avoided that. Clinton Robison had this to say about the last episode. It's where I covered Robotech Defenders. He said he loved the coverage of Robotech Defenders. Thanks a ton for playing my promo. He said, I have to say, as much as I enjoyed everything in this episode, when you called the need to slab Robotech Defenders issues a sickness, I had to pause the show so I could finish laughing like a madman. 10 out of 10. I got a comment from somebody else, and I don't remember who said it. It was essentially along the line of, I'm so glad you covered this because now I don't have to, or something like that. So that was amusing. If you've got any thoughts about this album, if you've got any thoughts about any of the other episodes, email me, comments on the blog, the show notes, hit me up on Twitter and Facebook, etc. Because that's going to do it for this month. Next time, in honor of the upcoming Summer Olympics in Paris, I'm going to sit down and talk about my Olympics fandom, and I will have a special guest coming along with me. You'll have to find out who it is, but until then, thanks for listening and take care. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Affidavit, which is produced by me, Tom Panarese. All clips are copyright their respective copyright holders and no infringement is intended. This podcast is a part of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you can find at twotruefreaks.com. If you like the show, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. It helps the show get noticed by other people.
Feedback via email can be sent to popcultureaffidavit@gmail.com. For show notes and essays and other things random in the world of popular culture, visit popcultureaffidavit.com. You can also follow this show on Facebook at facebook.com/popcultureaffidavit and on Twitter at popaff. That's P-O-P-A-F-F. Thanks for listening, and come back next time for more pop culture randomness.